This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island. From the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you.
Good evening. Welcome to the People Speak Radio. I'm Rob Kitzel, coming to you from Studio City, California. And tonight, on Columbus Day, special show, we have CJ Peters, MD, and he is here to talk about the topic that's on everybody's mind at the moment, Ebola. Good evening to you, Dr. Peters, sir.
Hi, good to be here.
Wonderful. Well, we'll get down to it, Dr. Peters. And I would like to personally ask you, what are your thoughts on the handling of this Ebola issue with the administration and the CDC?
Well, you know, we're not as a nation prepared to handle something really big. We made a lot of progress during the 90s and early 2000s while we were ramping up to be able to deal with a biological warfare threat, should one come. But we really don't have all the public health that we could use in place. I think that the people who are working in that area have done a great job. I mean, there have been a couple of minor slips, but overall, they've done a great job. And you got to realize this is a huge challenge. We don't have much in the public health arena, and what we have, I mean, as a nation, and what we have has been whittled away by budget cuts in the last 3 or 4 years. So I think, all in all, it's been a good response. We have a good medical system. We have good physicians, not attuned to public health, but that can be fixed and is being fixed. And we have good people in public health.
Okay. Now, Dr. Peters, do you think that it would have been more prudent of the administration to, and I'm not sure what the protocol would be with the CDC, but recently when there was an issue at the Ben-Gurion airport in Israel, where it was basically deemed dangerous for flights to fly into Tel Aviv airport because of Hamas and rocket strikes, basically the FAA issued an edict where they said that, you know, no US planes would be flying into Ben-Gurion Airport in Tel Aviv. Do you think it would have been prudent for the CDC to get together with the FAA and the administration to issue something and basically state that it wouldn't be prudent at this particular juncture to have flights? And maybe they could have got involved with maybe our European partners over there in the EU, where you've got major hubs in, you know, Schiphol Airport and Paris and Heathrow and, you know, in Belgium, where the flights have been coming from West Africa. Would it not have been prudent to try and send medical care into West Africa itself using, as you're fully aware of, the military, as you were actually in the US Army as a colonel and, you know, medical personnel in there? Would it not be more prudent to have the military, with assistance from the CDC and maybe some European health organizations, to have gone to Africa, isolated the threat, as opposed to really what's been going on with almost a laissez-faire attitude to, well, it's not going to really reach Europe and the United States. It's not going to be a problem. And, you know, a lot of people seem extremely concerned about the actions of the administration and the doublespeak from the head of the CDC. What's your thoughts on that, Doctor?
Well, I think it would have been very important to get more muscle into controlling the situation in West Africa. The major player there really has been MSF, Médecins Sans Frontières. They have done a lot, and a number of other organizations have also contributed, including CDC. But nobody has had the money. WHO is terribly underfunded, and they they're not my favorite organization in terms of understanding problems and amassing a response. And when they finally got onto it, they still didn't have any money. So I think that really we as an international system need to be ready to jump on these things. I think that we'll have to eliminate Ebola in West Africa, and I think we can do it. There are no known natural reservoirs. We could get a surprise, but there are no known natural reservoirs. So if we can eliminate it from West Africa, we can eliminate having to worry about it. In the meantime, I think it was it's a big deal to try to turn off commerce and trade between two countries, and it was apparent during the SARS outbreak, during the influenza threat, that it's hard to do, and it's very expensive, and it takes time to get around to it. So I think that the best thing to do was to put in the checks on incoming passengers that we have now and be prepared to deal with those. There will be probably some more Ebola cases, not many, but to be able to deal with those cases as they're suspected and as they come in. I think one of the things that I'm really concerned about is the American population seems to be very panicked, and if you saw one Ebola patient and you looked at him and thought that could be me, you'd have good reason for panic. But if you had one Ebola patient who came in and ended up in Dallas, and that's all you really had in terms of free living, floating in patients, then I think that there's really no reason for panic. That this is not a very transmissible disease. It's not like measles, for example, which we're all vaccinated, or most of us are, and measles has been underappreciated in the last few decades because of the vaccine, but it's a very transmissible disease, and we would be in a world of hurt if we didn't have that vaccine.
So do you think that, you know, what has happened with this nurse? Some people have stated that they think the virus is possibly becoming more airborne. Well, what are your thoughts on that?
I haven't seen any convincing evidence that the virus is any different from the Ebola that we know and love. It's all the evidence, all the incidents of transmission, with the exception of this nurse, seem to have involved the kinds of close personal contact that we're familiar with in these situations. We haven't seen anything that would indicate it was airborne. Now, let me put a little asterisk there and run down to the to think about other possibilities and the nurse and so on. You know, the when people are taking care of this virus, patients with this virus in Africa, and Africa is where we have most of our epidemiological data, they aren't doing complex medical procedures. They aren't intubating patients, and they aren't dialyzing patients. So it's possible that there's another aspect that's been brought in by performing these procedures. You know, during the SARS outbreak in 2002 or thereabouts, during the SARS outbreak, intubation of patients was extremely dangerous, and there were a number of cases in physicians as a consequence of this. No one was dialyzed, so we don't know about that particular aspect of SARS. But I think we can say that those are high risk procedures in Ebola patients. And I think that the physicians in on site made a decision that we owe these people everything that we can bring to bear. And it's possible that the nurse was infected some other way. It's also possible that the intubation of the patient and the renal dialysis of the patient were critical also.
Okay. Well, we have a somebody on the line who's Bob from Alaska on line two. If Don can patch him through to the doctor for his question, over to Bob from Alaska.
Hi, Bob.
Don, do we have Bob on the line?
Hello, Dr. Peters. Can you hear me?
Hi, you're clear.
Okay, great. Hey, Dr. Peters, a pleasure to be hearing you tonight. I have a question, okay? And certainly a lot of folks that have heard of Ebola have heard about it in the 90s. We're pretty aware of it. And my understanding is that back in the 90s, Ebola had about a 90-something percent mortality rate. And you can correct me if I'm wrong, but the symptoms showed up rather quickly, and that was sort of the Achilles heel of the virus. It died rather quickly or burned itself out as a result of such a high mortality rate. Now, this virus that we're dealing with now sort of reminds me, and I did a little research, it's sort of telling me that it might be the Marburg virus, which is in the same family of Ebola, has a longer incubation period, and the mortality rate is about 50-60%. And so what kind of gets me, and I don't want to throw you into another avenue here, the only country that weaponized Marburg, from my understanding, is the Soviet Union. And we had the Ebola outbreak now in December of 2013. That's when we had the issue with the Ukraine. I'm wondering if there might be a connection, or what do you know about Marburg? Thank you very much.
Well, Marburg is Ebola's brother. They both belong to the same virus family, and they have a lot of the same problems. And we thought for a long time that Marburg was not that transmissible because there were no ongoing epidemics, and we thought that it was not ever going to be a big public health threat. And then around 2000 in Angola, there was a big epidemic that had typical person-to-person spread, close contact, blood, that sort of thing, and really required a lot of effort to quell. It's interesting, when you work overseas, the people who were trying to work with this epidemic were not greeted in a very friendly fashion by the locals. They felt like these people from the outside were not trying to help them because they have a completely different framework that they operate from. They thought that when someone took blood for a diagnosis, maybe they were sending it back to a blood bank in the U.S. to give to somebody else, and things like that. And our medical staff, the European and North American medical staff, didn't understand this at first. They didn't have a good way to approach the locals that would gain acceptance. Eventually, they got over this and were able to got past this, and they were able to work with local people to try to stop the outbreak and succeeded. Now, could this be Marburg? Well, we're pretty sure it's not. By all the immunological tests, it's not Marburg. And it's also been sequenced by a couple of different laboratories. And the sequence is not like Marburg. It's like Ebola. It's like the Zaire subtype. Now, you've hit on something that I think is very interesting, and that is that the Ebola outbreaks with the Zaire species of Ebola have generally had a pretty high mortality rate. The first outbreak in 76 had a 90% mortality rate, and the outbreak in 95 that I was involved with had about an 80% mortality rate. And this outbreak only has a 50% reported mortality rate. Now, I don't know whether that's a real difference in the virus. I don't think it's a difference in medical care. I guess it's possible that people are miscounting, and that's always a reasonable hypothesis in the U.S. or especially in Africa, that we're just missing some cases so that the numerator doesn't have its full complement of deaths, or we're counting too many people in the denominator. So that's a worrying aspect, because we don't like for things to be different, do we? We like them to be the same.
Okay, that makes sense, Dr. Peters. Now, in 95, when you were involved in the outbreak there, how many people died, and how did it work when you were there in Africa? Did you have areas really sort of locked down in quarantine zones? What was the practice that you employed in 95?
Well, I think you hit on a very key aspect of things, and that is that the outbreak was in a town called Kikwit, which was big enough to support transmission. It was 250,000 people, and it was hard to get to and hard to get away from, so that most of the cases were in Kikwit itself or in nearby towns. Very few people traveled even as far as Kinshasa, the capital, where they could have taken an airplane to go somewhere else, or where there was a good bus or road route to go to another country. And this was a real help. When we got there, the virus was moving along quite rapidly in the population, and it had caused, as Ebola often does, two hospitals to be closed because of deaths in the medical staff. Local people also looked at that, and when you have a high case fatality rate, they look at it and they say, oh, if you go in the hospital, you come out dead. So people were staying away from the hospitals, both because they were closed and because they had a sort of a smelly reputation. We were lucky. Pierre Roland and Philippe Collin were on our team, and they went in and worked with the locals and were able to show them how to do barrier nursing in a very fastidious and careful way. Médecins Sans Frontières was there, and they had a lot of equipment with them that helped us to set up barrier nursing. And we were able to show that we could run a hospital successfully, maybe not to Western or to American standards, but certainly by local standards. We could run a hospital very successfully and take care of patients. And we began to be able to draw in more and more patients so they wouldn't infect other people. And that, I think, had a very positive effect on stopping the epidemic. I wouldn't say that we stopped the epidemic, because it's difficult to know exactly what goes into some of these things, but I think we had a lot to do with stopping it. We stopped it just in time, because people were beginning to develop feelings of persecution. One of the things that always happens in these big epidemics is that infected patients are ostracized by the community, and community ostracism led to families hiding patients, which led to small foci of continued transmission, and it took a while to finally get that tamped down. But in the end, the epidemic stopped, the hospital had been rehabilitated, and a lot of doctors and nurses from the town had survived, as well as, of course, some of the people that came with us. So I think it's a touchy situation, both because of the danger of the virus and the fact that you have to be very careful all the time, every minute, and when you're taking your protective gear off, you are particularly at risk. I don't know if anyone's discussed this on the radio or not, but when you get dressed in your protective gear, you got to get it on right, and there's usually somebody there to help you and check you out. Then you go in and you work with these patients, and you contaminate the surface of your protective gear and your gloves and so on. So they're covered with Ebola virus, and when you come out, these are very dangerous things because they're contaminated. You put on that garb to keep from becoming infected, but it has the Ebola virus on the outside. So when you start taking it off and stripping down to your normal clothing or your scrub suit, what you're usually wearing, then you are potentially exposing yourself. And I think that's a situation where people are infected from time to time. That may be what
happened to the nurse, doctor? Is that what may have happened to the nurse in Texas?
I think it's a good bet. That would be my number one bet. And you know, it's very subtle. She may not even have noticed what was going on. She may not have made a real obvious mistake. I think she's I've heard some people comment about how she must have been clumsy or whatever, but you know, when you go in to take care of somebody who has a potentially fatal transmissible disease, I think you've earned a lot of positive points there, and I don't think that she had any noticeable breach in containment. I suspect that it was something that was very subtle and not at all noticeable.
Okay. Well, let me just do a quick. We're not going to break yet, but we're going to remind our guests that the BBS Radio Network is on. We're on. You're able to contact us on 888-429-5471. That's toll free in the United States and Canada. With your questions for Dr. Peters. And if you're outside the United States and Canada, you can reach us on 530-763-1594. That's for outside the United States and Canada. At the moment now, we have Frank from Missouri, and he's on line two. Can you put Frank through to Dr. Peters, please, Don? Thank you.
Hello, Dr. Peters.
Hi.
I and most of my fellow Americans and Canadians are rather upset that physicians have decided that it's okay to allow aircraft to continue to fly back and forth to these infected areas. You know, if the first cases had been isolated, it wouldn't have spread to four countries or five countries, whatever it's in. We want these countries to be isolated and contained in quarantine. We do not want patients flying to Dallas and infecting a nurse or anybody else. And there were 100 people now that were infected, they could have been infected. We don't want this danger coming to our shores. There's no reason for this. And we want these people to be contained. This tragedy should not be allowed to stick its deadly fingers into other people's nations. And the first rule of containing an epidemic is to isolate the areas where the epidemic is taking place. You do not let these people fly in and out. Why are you saying that it's okay to do this? This is dangerous. I don't care what you think about the disease. No epidemic like this should be allowed to travel worldwide on these aircraft. This is absurd.
Well, I think it's pretty clear to those of us who work in the business that there really is no way to completely fence this in. I applaud the steps that have been taken dealing with incoming persons from West Africa, screening them for fever and giving them questionnaires. I realize that if you have a low-grade fever, you can suppress that with aspirin or Tylenol, and that people can lie on their questionnaires. But I think one of the major motives for lying is to get better medical care. And certainly if someone lied to get better medical care, if they get sick, they're going to come to a hospital. And I think this can be contained in hospitals. And in general, we have 4 hospitals in the country that are specifically dedicated to this. And other hospitals can be brought up to standards with the by being sure they have the right equipment and by teaching people the principles of care. If we tried to close things off, I can guarantee you that people would be going to other countries in Africa and flying from there without any link to West Africa. I think the way things have been done now or are being done now is to be able to go back through the manifest. So if you fly directly from West Africa to another airport and then link into the U.S., you'll be detected. But if you take a bus to Kinshasa or some other mode of transportation to get out of the 3 major affected countries, you could leave from one of these other places rather easily and fly through connecting ports to the U.S. And we wouldn't have any idea who they were, where they came from, where they might be going in the U.S. So I think it's better to accept the risk and get as much control over it as we can than to turn it loose and have people coming in from every direction that we don't know, we've never looked at, and we don't know where they're going to be going. The other thing about this is that if we're going to stop this, and I think we have to stop it, or we'll be this way for the rest of the rest of time, then we've got to be able to move people in there to assist in treatment, pump up the defenses against this disease, and bring them back when they've completed a rotation there. So I think it's I can understand your reaction and your reflex desire not to let anybody in. And if that would really work, I would think it would be a serious consideration. But I just don't think it would work, and I think it would be a major hindrance to our ever stamping out this disease. You know, these countries
I've heard this over and over again, Doctor, and no one's listening to us. We don't want it here. We don't want any Ebola patient coming to America or to London or to any other European nation. We want it contained. Now, you know as well as I do that you already got 10,000 cases, probably 20,000. In a few months, you're going to have 50,000 and then 100,000. And you've missed a chance to contain it. So it's totally out of control. You're not going to be able to stop it with 3,000 troops or even with 10,000 medical people, you know, with all the equipment that they need. This is already past the tipping point. There is no way you're going to contain this, and we don't want it coming here, period. Isolate it. Don't make us take these people here. We don't want them here.
You know, I wish we could do that. I wish we could wave a magic wand and have it go away and not have anyone come in this direction who might even conceivably be bringing Ebola or trypanosomiasis or any one of a large number of infectious diseases, but I just don't think we can do it. I think the best thing to do, and I don't agree with you that this is past control. I think the best thing to do is to get in there and beat it around the head and shoulders and control it. And I think that we were successful in Kikwit. We've been successful in all the other outbreaks. And in terms of succeeding in this country, if Ebola comes here with a person or two, or 10, or so on, I think that our country is more oriented toward understanding what are the real public health challenges and helping meet them.
Okay, well, I think that's...
Let me give you a scenario here, Doctor. What happens if the terrorists get a hold of an Ebola patient? And somehow they kind of grind him up and make a liquid out of his cellular self and go to a smorgasbord in New York City and spray it on the smorgasbord. And do this all over the country. One smorgasbord after another being sprayed with Ebola. Ebola put into school lunches, et cetera. What happens? What happens then?
Well, it would be a terrible disaster. And keeping, formally excluding people from West Africa wouldn't help that at all. I don't know if you remember Aum Shinrikyo, the Japanese cult that tried to disseminate anthrax and botulism in Tokyo, and that ended up with some sarin released on a Tokyo subway. They went to Africa looking for Ebola, and they couldn't find it. The reason they couldn't disseminate anthrax was because they weren't competent to do that. So I think that if someone obtained an Ebola patient and ground his gizzards up and put them in the in a smorgasbord anywhere in the U.S., I think it would be a real disaster. But I think that person, A, would be at risk of getting Ebola himself, and B, could be from anywhere. He could be from the North Pole, for that matter, and we wouldn't be able to stop him by putting a quarantine around West Africa.
Well, thank you, Doctor. That's a,
well, you're not going to be able to stop it in Africa, I don't think you're going to stop somebody from... I don't think you're going to ever stop somebody from spreading Ebola around with all the thousands of patients you have. All it takes is a few samples, and it's on its way with the terrorists doing whatever they want.
Well, I think that's a valid point, Frank, and we need some other callers to come in now. So thank you, Frank. And we're going to take a quick break now with the People Speak, BBS Radio Network. Please keep continuing with your calls on 888-429-5471, toll-free for Dr. Peters. And if you're outside the United States, 530-763-1594. Obviously, people are passionate about this topic. Please continue with your calls through to Dr. Peters as we take this quick break on The People Speak.
Got questions? The library's got answers, and books and magazines and CDs and videos and web access and databases and all sorts of other resources at your library. In a world that's information rich, libraries are information smart. Find the right answer and a whole lot more at your library.
With over 150 million registered users, PalTalk is the largest video chat community in the world, with over 300 PalTalk support staff speaking dozens of languages to help you enjoy your online experience. Meet new people across town or country or continent while chatting about your interests. Sing live karaoke, listen to music, join a lively political debate, or play group trivia in one of thousands of chat rooms in various categories from your PC, mobile, or tablet device. Joining PalTalk is free and easy. Go to paltalk.com and become part of our friendly community today.
In America, most of us have the basics we need to survive, but there are millions of children all over the world who don't. Children who must work instead of going to school. Children who were forced to fight as child soldiers. Children who can't have an ordinary childhood because they lack health care, clean water, or good nutrition. For these children, there is UNICEF. UNICEF works in 157 countries and territories, providing children with what they need to survive and grow. To learn more, visit unicefusa.org or call 1-800-4-UNICEF.
Hello, this is Wesley Snipes. And when I'm divinely inspired and spiritually motivated, I listen to BBSRadio.com.
In a world of abundance, hunger is a crime. When a malnourished child dies, we're all guilty. Yet it happens every 5 seconds. Let's do the right thing. Put hunger away for good. Please, give to the World Food Program.
This land is yours.
Join us on The People Speak for an hour of live interviews and audience interaction as guests of various organizations share their work and strategies which impact our world and make a difference. That's The People Speak every Tuesday, 6 to 7 p.m. Pacific, 9 to 10 p.m. Eastern on the BBS Radio Network.
This land was made for you and me.
Welcome back to The People Speak. Rob Kitzel in here, standing in on a special Columbus Day Monday with the Ebola chat, actually, with Dr. CJ Peters from Texas. Let's get back to some questions for Dr. Peters. On the line, line three is Rock. Rock's calling for Dr. Peters. Over to you, Rock.
Good evening, Dr. Peters. Dr. Peters, my question to you is, how is the CDC involved in this Ebola virus, and is this a lab-created virus that is being intentionally put out there if it is, what is it that you can tell us about it, and what is it we can do to stop it?
Well, the first time anyone met Ebola was in 1976, and it just appeared in northern Zaire and nearby another outbreak in Sudan. There was a lot of speculation and a lot of concern at that time. Then that epidemic was both controlled and died down. One of the reasons it died down was because the hospitals all closed, their staff largely deceased, and the people in these villages recognized that contact with someone with Ebola was not good for your health. So they started putting Ebola patients or sick people in their house and not letting them leave. If they survived, they could come out and join the community. If they died, they burned the house down. This was not exactly the best way to do it by our standards, but it was certainly effective. So the virus disappeared, and except for an occasional little flicker, it wasn't seen again until this outbreak in 1995 that we were talking about. When that outbreak happened, we sequenced that virus and compared it to the genetic sequence of the 76 virus, and they were virtually identical. And that led us to wonder if, like some flu strains, this virus had been in a freezer someplace and not evolving. But it turns out, later, a couple of smart virologists were able to find that the reservoir of this virus was with fruit bats. As you probably know, they're big bats that are called fruit bats and little bats that are called insectivorous bats. And this seems to be a virus of the large fruit bat. And so we concluded that, and other evidence has come up since then, that this was a naturally occurring virus. I don't know if you've watched television and seen how funny it looks on the screen with these little crooked rods and so on. That's the only virus that looks like that. So we were relieved to find it present in bats all over Africa at the same time that we were concerned that it meant it had a very wide distribution and that we were probably stuck with it forever. The transmission, we don't understand the transmission between bats, but the transmission between humans requires this close contact with people and particularly with body fluids that I talked about before. So we've controlled the outbreaks by sequentially quarantining people who showed up with disease. The typical incubation period for this virus is around 7 to 10 days, but if you look at the 76 outbreak, it looks as though there were some cases that took as long as 3 weeks to come up. So we quarantined people for 3 weeks, and then we feel like we can, by doing this, we can control the chains of transmission. And one of the things that we'd like to do with this virus is get a good vaccine or a good therapy where we could give a drug that would control the virus. We could give it after people got sick. But we don't have any of those things. There was a period in the 90s when there was a fair amount of money available, and several drugs were tried, and several vaccines were developed. But these were all tested in monkeys and had not been tested in humans, except for perhaps a few volunteers. So now we need these things desperately. And we don't have them. We have leads, but by the time we get something drummed up, it will probably be too late to have a significant impact on the human disease. But the National Institutes of Health have put these things on a fast track. A couple of companies seeing opportunity to develop a useful and profitable product have leapt into this, and we're hoping that we'll have something maybe even for the end of this epidemic, if it lasts as long as our friend from Missouri thinks it will, and if not, at least for the next epidemic.
You stated something that's kind of, in a sense, scary, because you said profitable. And it all seems to be about profit. And could this be something that's been put out precisely so they can profit off of it?
Well, I don't think so, because there was nobody really working in this area until recently, and they're not people who have a basis for doing this kind of work. The way these things have been really brought along is that the basic research has been funded by the U.S. Army, concerned about biological warfare, or NIH, concerned about public health. And scientists and universities have worked with these bugs and found a good start on drugs and a good start on vaccines. So it's only after we started having these problems recently that the companies have really become interested. And these are usually not the big companies. They're not big pharma like Merck and so on. They're smaller companies. And, you know, it's good to have them involved because they have a lot of know-how and bring a lot of expertise to the area.
Now, Dr. Peters, I'd just like to interject here. You were you not, involved with the monkeys that were infected just outside Washington, D.C., in Reston, Virginia? Does this have any bearing on this? How did those monkeys become infected? And how dangerous was that incident that, you know, you were extremely, from what I've read, involved in basically stopping any transmission of Ebola from those monkeys? What's your thoughts on that? Can you talk about that?
Sure. We were, I think the only way to describe it is we were puckered when we found this. The group that worked together at USAMRIID, about 30 miles away, was charged with biological warfare defense. And we felt like any bug that killed monkeys would be dangerous for humans, at least until we'd shown otherwise. So we were fishing around among the primate veterinarians to maintain a surveillance over monkey diseases. And when this broke out, a colleague at the monkey facility sent samples to USAMRIID, and Peter Jarling, an excellent virologist who was working at the time, isolated a strain of Ebola virus from this. Now, this was in the mid-80s, and we didn't have the sequencing ability that we have now. Now we can obtain the sequence of these bugs relatively cheaply and relatively quickly. But at that time, it was almost impossible to get any decent sequence information in time to deal with an outbreak. So all we knew is that it looked like Ebola. And, you know, there's this old joke about if it looks like a duck and quacks like a duck and walks
like
a duck. I'm sorry?
Absolutely. I can see where you're going with this, Doctor, yeah. So was it not Ebola with the monkeys, or was it something similar?
It was Ebola. Turns out there are 5 species of Ebola that we've been able to sort out through sequencing. But at the time, we didn't know. It was just Ebola. So we dealt with it among the monkeys, mainly by euthanizing the monkeys and decontaminating the facility. As background, the original isolation of Marburg virus was made in Marburg, Germany, because they had brought in, a drug company there had brought in monkeys to use for making vaccines out of their kidney cells. And fortunately, before they could make any vaccines, the monkeys began to die, and a few of the monkey handlers died. So they thought it was not a good idea, and they did essentially the same thing we did. This was named Marburg virus because of the site. Since then, we found that it is, although it's pathogenic for monkeys, it's not really pathogenic for humans. And we've also found that it originated from the Philippines, which is where these monkeys came from. We didn't think that there were any filoviruses, any Ebola viruses anywhere except Africa. But these monkeys came from the Philippines. At first, we looked. The traffic in monkeys is pretty pretty grody. They are captured, and they go into holding facilities overseas, and there may be African monkeys there, and there's a possibility of cross-contamination and so on. But to wind this story up, it does appear to be a Philippine virus, an Asian virus.
Okay. Well, that's good to know. Well, we have a couple more people on the line, Doctor. Everybody wants to speak to you, a very popular man. So we will put you through now to Rob in Southampton, New York. Rob in Southampton, New York, on for Dr. Peters.
Thank you. Appreciate it. First of all, Dr. Peters, thank you for your service. Much appreciated. My question is, you know, with regard to the gentleman from Missouri, you know, I don't agree with him on much, but on this, I think he's right. I mean, we need to be letting in the Mr. Duncans of the world like we need a hole in our head, it seems to me. And I'm just wondering how many more nurses and frontline medical personnel you're willing to sacrifice on the altar of, I guess, political correctness or diversity or whatever the catchphrase seems to be at the time. How many more do we have to sacrifice so that, you know, people who really don't have a right to be here in the first place can come here for medical treatment? And do you think that protecting American citizens is somehow lower on the totem pole than, say, keeping these people who are infected out of the country? I mean, in your worldview, because I'm just trying to understand this, because I've heard people like you, like the head of the CDC, make the statement that unless we allow travel, that somehow inhibits us from fighting the disease, as if we don't have military assets to get people who are actually trained over there to do the work that needs to be done. I mean, can you, first off, explain how allowing commercial flights helps us? Because, you know, to my mind, it really doesn't. And how many more Mr. Duncans are you willing to let in?
Well, I think that's an admirable proposition, if it were possible. I mean, we could argue about whether we have to take care of the world or not, but it's a little bit like the terrorist situation. Unless we get rid of the terrorists where they are or tamp them down, we can deal with, we'll have to deal with them here. So I would have to say that if this disease is as transmissible as you seem to think it is, it's going to be a real problem, and we'll have a lot of doctors sacrificed to deal with it in this country. It would only take one.
Won't we have that many more if we continue to allow medical tourism from places where the outbreak is uncontrollable? I mean, I could see if Mr. Duncan was, you know, the front lines of, you know, Doctors Without Borders, but this is someone just engaged in medical tourism. And my question to you is, how many are you willing to let in, and is there ever a point, because obviously we're not there yet, but at what point would you rethink that and say, you know, maybe it's not good to have people flying commercially. Maybe we should restrict. I mean, other countries have done it. I'm just wondering how many more infected it'll take before we get there.
Do you think we should have people from London flying here?
Not if London. If London was undergoing a level 5 outbreak, I'd have to say no.
Well, people from West Africa fly quite often to London. London
so
has
then
had.
That sounds like an take up by stopping connector flights. I mean, you're basically saying we can't do anything about it, so don't try doing anything. That pretty much seems to be the gist of it. And all I'm saying is that may be true. These people may get here by other means, and that's regrettable. But we shouldn't be aiding and abetting them getting here.
Well, we're not aiding and abetting them. If they have the money to buy a ticket, and if they have that kind of money, they can go to other places like London and fly here. I mean, if there were a way to absolutely kibosh travel, it would be a reasonable thing to think about doing it. But I'm not cavalier about the death of American medical people at all.
If we could stop 90% of the people who are infected from getting here, that's not a worthwhile cause because we didn't get 100%. Is that the logic?
If this virus is as transmissible as you're implying that it is, then if we can tamp down the people who are coming over through screening with temperature and questionnaires, and I put a lot more faith in the temperature than the questionnaires, then I think...
But even the temperature could be... If you take a bunch of ibuprofen, you could mask your fever. I mean, and, you know, not for nothing, I wouldn't give you such a hard time if I really thought that the people in power were competent. But, you know, I'm sure you're aware that the president told us not 3 weeks ago, that it was unlikely to even get here. And the CDC backed him up and said, well, you know, even if it got here, we would stop it in its tracks cold. That narrative couldn't withstand, 2 weeks? So, you know, there's not a high level of trust working with these people because they don't seem to be all that competent. You would concede that, would you?
Well, I think that you got to deal with what the epidemiologists and the physicians say, and I'm both, so maybe I'm prejudiced that way. But I certainly didn't say that we wouldn't ever see any in this country.
Let me put it like this: would you concede that when they come out and tell you something definitively 2 weeks? And then 2 weeks go by, and it's 180 degrees from what they said wasn't likely to happen. Do you think that that inspires confidence? And number two, given that they were so wrong about those two preceding events, is it such a stretch to believe that they may be wrong about the air travel as well, or is that just a bridge too far?
I don't think they're wrong about the air travel. I happen to agree with them on that. And I happen to agree with them on the premise that we can stop Ebola in this country because of the differences in sanitation, in public health, and in hospital care. I just think that gives us a big edge over the virus. It doesn't mean that the virus is innocuous or that there won't be some people who die, but I think if we try to keep this virus out and try to separate ourselves in an absolute way from West Africa, we'll fail in the separation and we'll be plagued with this problem for a very long time.
Well, I tell you what, Dr. Peters, on that we're going to have to close this special edition of Columbus Day Ebola People Speak Radio. We do really thank you for your input, sir. I know some of the questions were rather passionate, but I must say we thank Dr. Peters. Maybe Dr. Peters can come back. I have a feeling this is not the last we've heard of Ebola. And I think you can see, Dr. Peters, a lot of people are extremely concerned and worried about the transmission of this disease. And we do sincerely appreciate your expertise, sir.
Well, I'm glad to be here because I think people want to know about this. And I like to try to give them at least my perspective. And I'm glad that Columbus didn't bring Ebola in 1492.
No, he didn't. And we're thankful for Columbus not bringing any. Anyway, thank you, Dr. Peters. Thank you for all the people that called in. And don't forget to listen in to The People Speak tomorrow night. Thank you all for coming to the show.
One bright sunny morning in the shadow of the steeple by the Raleigh Confess, I saw my people and they stood there hungry and I stood there wondering if this land was made for you and me. This land is your land. This land is my land, from California to the New York Island, Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. Yeah, this land is made for you and me.